Hello, and welcome to the Swan Vivash Audio Walk. You've downloaded the walk that follows the path from the Woodbridge Riverside Park to the car park at the Reg Bond Reserve, and you should be standing near the sealed path outside of the play area. A jetty and boat landing are to your left. This walk is about 2 kilometres and will take you about 45 minutes to an hour. There are plenty of benches along the way if you want a rest. In fact, I'd encourage you to take your time and look around while you listen to the history and imagine the people and places described for you. As you walk, you'll be directed to a landmark where you can listen to the next story. After that story, you'll receive directions to the next landmark. When the directions are finished, you'll be asked to press pause and move to the next landmark. Just to make things easier, when each story has finished, you'll hear a bell. That's the signal that you're about to hear directions to the next landmark. Some are quite close to each other, and the directions are simple, but others will need a turn on the footpath. Make sure you have plenty of water and wear sunscreen and a hat, especially in the summer. Europeans began settling in the area in 1829, but the Whadjuk Noongar people have inhabited the area for more than 50,000 years. As you take the walk, remember that you're on Aboriginal land, and please show respect. And thank you to the City of Swan for providing funding for this and the Guildford Walk, and the Swan Guildford Historical Society, who generously auspiced the project. With this walk, we're paying special attention to the landscape history. You'll hear about the prehistoric formation of the river through the Ice Ages, the arrival of the first people, down to the European settlers, and how each force, geological or human, has influenced the landscape. For our story, please walk through the trees, past the green building to the left of the path, to a short bridge with steel rails. Cross that, and to your left is a bench overlooking the river. Take a seat, and I'll tell you about the river during the Age of the Dinosaurs. Press pause now, and talk to you there. As you're walking along the path, look at the river, and you can observe two things. One, it isn't very wide here, compared to further down past the Narrows Bridge, where it broadens out and it meanders quite distinctly. In geological terms, it looks like a young river still, you could say, finding its way in the world. Geologists like to talk about 1 million years as though that was yesterday. Even so, the river's youthful appearance is deceptive. The Swan, which begins near Beverley, was formed around 70 million years ago, during the Cretaceous period, the age of the great dinosaurs like T-Rex, Triceratops and Velociraptors. Yes, well after the Jurassic era. When it was still a thin creek, you could, as George Seddon says in his book Sense of Place, stand here, watching the dinosaurs wander past. If you're wondering where the fossils are, there are lots about, though they're small, seashells and worm casings. But it's thanks to them we really understand the history of the river. Fossils of shells nearby at Caversham show that around 100,000 years ago, this area was underwater. The sea probably reached the escarpment. There are also fossils of freshwater mussels that couldn't survive now due to salinity, which is one reason why we know they're so old. If you're still looking for dinosaur fossils, you might want to head past Rottnest to the Great Canyon that lies just the other side of the island and is now underwater. Tens of millions of years ago, fresh water flowed past here into the canyon and to the great creatures, big and small, that lived there. But come forward a few years, quite a few million that is, to the period known as the Pleistocene, that started about 2 million years ago, and which we sometimes call the Ice Age. Really, that should be plural. There are several, even numerous ice ages. During this period, the landscape is dynamic. It is rarely, if ever, covered in ice here, but with freezing and thawing in other regions, there are erratic fluctuations in water levels. Frequently, this area is deep underwater. This glacial period will last across the planet till about 100,000 to 11,000 years ago, meaning it affected regions around the world differently. By the end of the last ice age, or what is sometimes called the start of the Holocene, this area might have been cooler and wetter, but we would recognise the river, its shape, even the vegetation on its banks. During the late Pleistocene, Homo sapiens emerged from Africa and spread across Asia. Along the way, you'll encounter our cousins, the Neanderthals and the Denisovans. We know people arrived here at least 50,000 years ago, yet the earliest remains of people in Scotland date back about 11 or 12,000 years, even though it's much closer to Africa. Until about 12,000 years ago, Scotland was under a blanket of ice, a kilometre thick in some places. This part of the world wasn't, which explains that conundrum. With the ice ages, we'll see the emergence of megafauna, like the mammoth in the Northern Hemisphere. And here, we'll see some of the proto-marsupial megafauna, Murrayglossus, the sheep-sized echidna, the diprotodon, the giant wombat, enormous kangaroos, and others. There are two theories regarding their extinction, which on the record look swift and dramatic. One, the overkill theory, says that humans hunted them to extinction. That argument was stronger when the record showed humans arriving just before the extinction, about 15,000 years ago. But we now know people were in Australia for tens of thousands of years before the extinction. So, the second theory, that it was climate change, is looking stronger. Now, to hear about this area after the Ice Ages, walk to the next bridge, with the Jarrah Columns. Jarrah features in our next story, so press pause and talk then. If you were walking through here about 30,000 years ago, so after the earliest records we have for a human presence, you would be some way inland. The coast began beyond Rottnest, and you'd be on a continent called Sahul. Tasmania, New Guinea, and parts of Indonesia would be joined to Australia. It was the last glacial maximum, and the sea level was in gradual retreat. It was colder than at present, though the ice cap hadn't reached this far. It would also be windy and dry, with very little rain. That began to noticeably change about 14,000 years ago, when the climate warmed and became wetter. The scrubby, windswept interior, with its giant wombats and echidnas, is giving way to the forest. One of the things to think about with Australian trees is that within regions, they're limited to a very few genera. Eucalypts, Banksia, Melaleucas and Acacia, with rare or occasional examples of pines or other outliers. On top of that, there is a pattern of limited genera growing in specific areas. Before colonisation, there may have only been two prevalent eucalypts growing along the riverbank, most likely Marri and Jarrah, next to the peppermint and a couple of Melaleucas, including the paperbark. Why such a limited variety? One very likely reason is the uniformity of climate. If you draw a line between Geraldton and Bunbury, about 600 kilometres, you have very much the same climactic system and geography. On the other hand, draw a line 600 kilometres anywhere along the coast in Europe, and you'll encounter at least two. Travel 600 kilometres around the coast of Britain, and there are more. So, while there may be several species of eucalyptus between Geraldton and Bunbury, within regions, one or two will dominate. As the ice ages drew to a close, and the temperatures warmed, and rains became more frequent, the river became a life source. This landscape of wetland and eucalypt was the favourite of the thylacine, Tasmanian tiger, which was on the mainland till about 3,000 years ago. Not just trees, but flowering bushes and wetland grasses emerged. It was a landscape that appears similar to the one you see today, with a couple of exceptions. When European settlers arrived in Guildford, they noticed a small striped creature everywhere along the river. It was the numbat, our state mammal emblem. Firstly, since Europeans colonised the area, vegetation has been cleared and new plants introduced, some as crops, others became invasive and unwanted. The arum lilies and Watsonia are obvious examples of that. So too the double G. There are feral animals to consider. Rats, cats, rabbits and foxes, which do incredible damage to native wildlife, not to mention the landscape. You may not think of some as feral. The kookaburra was introduced from the eastern states in the 1890s because it was such a good snake hunter. It is now officially considered a pest. The pink and grey galah turned up on its own, uninvited. When you look at the way they behave, that's entirely within their nature. The arrival of feral plants and animals changed the landscape in unpredictable ways. They predicated the rapid extinction of native creatures, bettongs, woylies, rufous hair wallabies, the big-eared hopping mouse and others, upsetting a balance in place for thousands of years. If an apex predator, like a chuditch, the western quoll, disappears, the creatures it preys on will flourish, putting pressure on the vegetation now being overeaten. 200 years ago, just before Europeans arrived, the vegetation here was denser, the animal life more abundant. You would have seen small marsupials like quolls scrabbling through the undergrowth, wallabies and kangaroos grazing nearby, and eagles circling overhead. You would have heard the throaty boom of emus and smelt the peppermint mingling with the eucalypt. You might think this part of the world had everything, and quite a few people would agree with you. Now, follow the path till you come to a fence dividing the pedestrian path with a gravel one, forking to its left. Soon, you'll hear about the very early Aboriginal history, but first, the gravel path will take you close to the river. But it floods after heavy rains, and when that happens, expect to get your shoes muddy. If you need assistance along the path, then the tarmac is best. Got that? Great. Press pause and talk to you near the fence. In the 1980s, archaeologists uncovered stone tools near here that could be dated to about 40,000 years ago. The 1980s was at a time when most archaeologists argued Aboriginal people had arrived about 25,000 years ago. But there's an even more remarkable statistic. With supporting evidence from other nearby sites and other information, including oral histories, it can be said that this area around Guildford and Midland has the longest record of continual human occupation anywhere in the world. That statement can easily be misinterpreted. Of course, there are sites in Africa and even Britain with hominid remains that can be dated much earlier, but these might be in caves or other areas where the record of human usage is broken. So there is no evidence of anyone else entering the space or area for thousands of years. And thanks to developments in technology, our understanding of the history of human occupation of this planet is developing so quickly that a statement made last year may already be redundant. Still, the record stands. For over 40,000 years, people have lived in the Guildford area. You'll recall at the last stop, I talked about the last glacial period that ended about 12,000 years ago. We know that Homo sapiens, that's us, were active in Europe and Asia, as were Neanderthals, Denisovans, Homo florensis, aka the Hobbit, and other hominid species. Parts of the Northern Hemisphere were covered with ice and uninhabitable, while down here in Sahul, the problem with water was there wasn't enough. Across the planet, the record of human habitation during this period is sketchy. Sensibly, humans, or hominids, gathered in pockets where habitation was possible, where they weren't in danger from rising or falling sea levels, and where the climate was milder. So we might find a lot of evidence of their presence in one area and next to nothing nearby. The tools found near here indicate it must have been a very livable region. The river provided water, and the temperature wasn't unbearable. Something else to think about. Across Australia, some 24 Aboriginal language families have been identified, with some containing several dialects. Noongar belongs to the Palmer Noongar branch, which has nearly 300 dialects. The language spoken in this area is Whadjuk. Further south, people speak Binjarab or Bibbulmun. As dialects, these may not be comprehensible to a Whadjuk speaker, though he or she would recognise they were the same family. Language maps tell us a lot of the history. Palmer Noongar covers most of the continent, while the other families are concentrated in the Kimberley and Northern Territory. Aboriginal language families are remarkably consistent in the way they're self-contained in specific areas. Look at a Native American language map of North America, and you'll see languages spoken in northern Canada have a pocket down in Nevada, and some on the plains are also dispersed. A language map of Africa shows the migratory routes of the Bantu language family from central to southern Africa. These maps tell us that in North America and Africa, migration and colonisation were active forces. Here in Australia, on the other hand, the sense is that trade and commerce were more important. A proto-Palmer Noongar ancestor of the Whadjuk languages would have been spoken by the people who left the stone tools near here. A modern-day Aboriginal person might not understand them, but they'd recognise some grammar rules and some words would sound familiar. Of course, there would be language evolution, but compared to, say, English, we struggle to understand Shakespearean English, only 500 years old, the development is much slower and more uniform. That only happens when people inhabit a region isolated and protected from invaders. What happened when those invaders arrived is part of our next stop. Walk along the fence line to its end. This is quite a long stretch, but spare a thought for a group of French sailors who had to row up here in 1801. Press pause and talk to you at the other end of the fence. In 1800, Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte commissioned an expedition to map the coast of New Holland, as Australia was called. Unlike British expeditions, which were weighted towards military and engineering, this was devoted to science. Under the command of Nicolas Baudin, who captained the Geograph, and Jacques Hamelin, captain of the Naturalist, the expedition would not only chart the coast, but collect zoological and botanical samples and communicate with the local inhabitants. In 1800, expansion of knowledge and expansion of empire were much the same thing, but Baudin had no orders to claim territory for France, otherwise, of course, you wouldn't be listening to this in English. Just because the French explorers weren't rabid imperialists bent on conquering new territory doesn't mean they were necessarily better at their job than the British. One of the problems with putting highly skilled cartographers, hydrographers, botanists, and zoologists in the same boat is that each will think his job is the most important, and also each has different requirements. Hydrographers are busy mapping ocean floors and currents, while botanists are onshore collecting plants. The clash of egos was as explosive as it was predictable. The story of how midshipman Francoise Antoine Harrison ended up charting the Swan River to a point very near here begins with a series of temper tantrums and a storm off the West Australian coast that separated the two ships. Hamelin, on the Naturalist, anchored off Rottnest, was waiting for Baudin on the Geograph to appear at what was their agreed rendezvous in the event of separation. This is in June 1801. After a day or two waiting, Hamelin instructed Freycinet to prepare a party to survey Rottnest Island. Two others would explore the coast and river. Hamelin put Harrison in charge of a longboat, and with a party of 10, including the mineralogist Charles Bailey, he set out to chart the Swan. The first night they stopped somewhere near King's Park and probably climbed Mount Eliza. Here, Charles Bailey noted, "From the top of this hill, One enjoys a very fine view. One sees the river in one direction, reaching a distant mountainous plateau, and in the other pursuing its course to the ocean. The two banks appear to be almost completely covered in beautiful forests that stretch a very long way inland. The rock, which is sometimes exposed, is of the same nature as those I spoke of earlier. Like them, it's calcareous, sandy and shelly. Up to this point, Bailey hadn't been impressed by what he saw. Limestone and sandstone, which is what he was describing, were sedimentary rock forms of little interest to anyone keeping note of soil fertility. On the second day, they hit the shallows, near the island that bears Harrison's name today, and spent some 13 hours dragging the longboat through the shallows and over the sandbars. The party almost gave up at this point, but pushed on. Bailey wrote, "All the country we saw this day is very low-lying and almost sunken, a layer of coarse sand, seemingly originating from ancient rock, covers a very thick bank of stiff, reddish clay." They're near Bayswater at this point. Bailey continues, "Retained by the argillaceous layer, rainwater and dew remain on the surface of the ground, seep into the quartzy sand and form small muddy pools. The next day, they find a well they believe was built by people and fill their water containers. The river led towards the mountains, where they thought they'd find the source. But after a few hours, with supplies running low and the mountains no closer, they decided to return to the naturalist. We know that they were very close to where we are standing now, because one result of the expedition was a map so accurate that you could use it today. You can find a copy online through the Batty Library and see for yourself how accurate their work was. It's typically attributed to Freycinet, but it was really the work of Bailey and Harrison." One thing you notice is that after Harrison Island, the party was out of the estuary and into what Bailey described as the hinterland proper. Between what we think of as Bayswater and Guildford, Harrison and another sailor, Moreau, went into the bush, where they came across what they described as a giant footprint. Was it human? Or the spoor of a kangaroo or emu that had been distended in the mud? On their return, they were at the shallows near Harrison Island again, when they heard a fearful noise that filled us with terror. It was like the roaring of a bull, but much louder, and appeared to come from the reefs. Was it, as some have speculated, a small army of frogs, bitterns, or some other creature? Like the giant footprint, the mystery remains. Walk a little further, and you'll come to some jarrah benches by the riverbank. That's a good place to learn something about the landscape and Noongar seasons. Press pause and talk then. Back to that mysterious sound. You might ask if it was the woggle, the serpent that inhabits the Noongar dreaming. If it had any idea of what lay ahead, it would try to frighten off the invaders. Back in 1929, 100 years after colonisation, there were reports of a monster in the Avon, which becomes the Swan, northeast of here, at Walyanga. These reports were taken so seriously that armed police patrolled the river searching for the creature. One night, a police inspector named Johnson saw it near Northam. By now, it was being called an alligator, with speculation it had escaped from the Perth Zoo. Had anyone asked, the zoo could have looked to see if any crocodiles or alligators in its collection were missing. Some witnesses disputed that description. On January 26, 1929, the Mirror reported, "Sometimes it's equipped with a crocodile's head, sometimes it's like a shark, and sometimes it has a horrible snout like a pig." People saw something. Was it related to the noise that frightened Harrison's party? I can't say yes or no, but it does lead us into that fascinating world of lore, L-O-R-E, and the way we respond to landscape. It's especially interesting when Aboriginal law gets filtered through settler law. We're seeing that happen now with the Noongar seasons. There are six of these seasons, and as more settlers and immigrants became familiar with them, it changes the way they read the landscape. The standard Western model of four seasons is based around the lunar calendar, which means summer, autumn, winter, spring begin on the same days regardless, those being the equinoxes, the days the sun rises and sets due east or west, and the solstices, when the sun sets at its most northerly or southerly point. The Noongar seasons are not so definite. They depend upon changes in the landscape. If you're walking this path around mid-August, you'll notice the explosion of yellow wattle flowers. That's one sign that we've entered Jilba. Another is that some of the nesting birds hatch their young. Is the jarrah in flower? Then it's Boonaroo. How about the flowers of the peppermint tree? And does there appear to be more swans about than usual? It's Makuru. Once you become familiar with the signs of the Noongar seasons, you'll see that in some ways, it's a far more efficient way of reading the landscape. Climate change has made the certainties of the lunar calendar, well, uncertain. The summer seasons feel longer. The winters may not be as cold or as wet, or they may be colder and wetter. With the Noongar system, the season doesn't begin until the signs are in place, and they are evidence that the numerous forces influencing weather have reached some equilibrium, even though climate change is affecting that. Learning the Noongar seasons helps us read the landscape, not so that it fits with our idea of the seasons, but so that we put the landscape first. It's September the 1st, traditionally the first day of spring, but it's cold and wet, and the river has swollen with late rains. But are the wattle in flower? Are there other signs that tell us, not that it's spring, but Jilba? If there are, this bad weather is just a couple of off days, perhaps. But if not, then something may be disrupting the cycle. It may be a sign that El Niño or La Niña are on their way. The full story of the Avon River monster can be read at the Dusty Box, www.dustybox.com, Jessica Barrett's trove of astonishing stories from WA's history. Now we're going to walk along till we come to a concrete path lined with jarrah posts branching to our left. Just across the water from there is Sandleford's, one of the first wineries in the region, but not the first. To hear about that, press pause and talk to you at the concrete path. Along the walk, pay attention to the soil. You'll recall that on his journey up the Swan in 1801, mineralogist James Bailey described the soil between the river mouth and King's Park as very ordinary, as sand dunes really, and it wasn't till he came up here that he had much more promising things to say. It's silt, clay and gravel here, or alluvial soils washed down from the escarpment. In parts around here, the Guildford Formation, as it is known, is over 30 metres deep, showing just how long the process has been at work. It's also just outside the borders of the sand and limestone regions of the Swan Coastal Plain. Governor James Stirling wasn't as objective as Bailey. In his desperation to see a military presence on the Swan River, he ignored some obvious signs, especially to do with the soil, with the result that the first colonists quickly realised they'd invested heavily in beach sand and swamp marsh. Those visions of a little England with sheep in the meadows and apple orchards in fruit began to quickly wither. But there was one plant that showed promise. In October 1829, 34-year-old Thomas Waters arrived on the Caroline. He was described simply as a gardener and botanical collector. But those few words tell us a lot. That he was called a gardener and not a botanist suggests he was not college trained, but probably apprenticed. But that he was also called a botanical collector indicates he must have been held in higher regard than most gardeners. He had been living and working in Cape Town, South Africa, when he applied to settle at the colony. And in his letters to other nurserymen in England, he uses the Latin for plant names, which is something only professionals would do. You can read those letters at the Batty Library. He left Cape Town for the colony, carrying some grapevine cuttings, but not just ordinary cuttings. These were from the Constantia Vineyards, a region just outside of Cape Town that had been growing grapes since the 1680s. Constantia wines were world famous in the early 1800s because Napoleon considered them his favourites. By October 1829, reports from the Swan River colony were only beginning to filter back to England, and the horrors of starvation hadn't sunk in. Thomas Waters must have read Stirling's glowing reports in Cape Town and made the assumption that since it was roughly on the same latitude and reports suggested that the climate and geography were similar, what grew well around Cape Town would also grow well at the new colony. Of course, he may have gathered other plants destined to fail, but he was right about grapevines. When he landed, he applied for a lot in South Guildford. You'll notice on the old maps that these lots are long and thin, some you could barely squeeze a house in sideways. Stirling had promised each investor would receive river frontage. He forgot to explain that once the limestone cliffs and swamplands were taken into account, large swathes of the river's edge were unusable as farmland. To uphold his end, Stirling had to create lots that in parts, especially around here, were long and thin, or ribbon lots as they were known. Waters was granted lots 24 and 25 in South Guildford. Both were thin, but also short, indicating he invested a few pounds only. Ask anyone who claims to be an expert on wine, and they'll tell you that certain grapes need specific conditions, that the soil type, the location, even which side of the river the vines are planted mean something. Did Waters have that kind of knowledge stored away? He planted the grapes that did well at Cape Town. What he did know is that the progress from vine to bottle is slow. It wasn't until 1832 that he was able to sell his first vintage. By August 1843, the Inquirer could describe his efforts this way. "It will, however, be evident to everyone here that we possess a climate greatly superior to that of New South Wales for vineyards. In fact, so much so as to render some parts of those letters quite inapplicable. This should, of course, form an additional incentive to our exertions. And it's to be hoped that we shall soon see all our settlers imitating the good examples set them by some, among whom we feel bound, especially to notice Mr. Thomas Waters, who by his unassisted labour has planted about 6 acres of vines and has accordingly above 300 gallons of good strong wine of last vintage, and expects of course several times that quantity when the whole vineyard comes into bearing. Wine would become one of the defining aspects of Guildford. So much so, it earned a place on the town crest, along with an anchor and a sheaf of wheat. So, we're almost at the end. I'll talk to you at the car park, just a short way along the path. Press pause now and talk then." So, I hope you came away learning something about this area you didn't know earlier. I mentioned George Seddon's sense of place, his landscape history of the Swan River. Another book about the geology and ancient landscape is Ernest Hodgkin's Swanland. Both are available through your local library. Dr. Noel Nanup, OAM, provided the cultural advice. The audio was mixed and recorded at Fremantle Recording Studios. Thanks to the City of Swan for providing funding for the audio walks, and to the Swan Guildford Historical Society for auspicing the project. Another walk is based in Guildford and Stirling Square. Take that walk and you hear about some early inhabitants who have sometimes escaped the close attention of historians, but nevertheless have fascinating stories to tell. Talk to you in Guildford.